This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. The September terrorist attacks were a shocking blow to the entire nation. 3 months later, one of the nation's top child psychiatrists evaluates the lasting impact on children. Is this a generation lost or one that will find new purpose and a voice all its own in this post-9/11 world? In this hour, Dr. Lynn Punton gives her diagnosis of America's children now. But first, new developments on the legal front in the war on terror. New details are coming out about how military tribunals will operate. Earlier, I spoke with George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley and asked for his verdict on the plans.
The administration is clearly taking a step back from the initial design of these tribunals. It was initially presented that these tribunals would effectively serve as drumhead trials, that these would be trials in the field to determine guilt according to standards designed by the administration. And so the addition of an appeal process, the requirement of a unanimous vote for death penalties, all of that certainly improves this creation. In some ways, however, it may be window dressing in terms of the more serious constitutional questions. I happen to have some real concerns about the constitutionality of the tribunal, and none of these changes would necessarily rectify that. What they would do is they would eliminate some constitutional issues, such as the appellate issue and the unanimous vote issue. Mm-hmm. Those will certainly take some issues partially off the table. What remains, however, is still the more fundamental question of whether the executive branch can create, without congressional approval, a wholly self-contained court system and presumably some type of incarceration system.
And is that the point at which all of this intersects with the Constitution, around the constitutionality of that power that the president has exercised here?
In my view, it does. That there are two distinct types of challenges to this tribunal. One deals with the individual rights of the defendants. That's a little bit uncertain because they're not American citizens and this is happening outside our borders. But a more serious question are separation of powers questions, that is, the right of the executive branch to do this unilaterally. These changes don't affect those second group of questions.
As a lawyer, when you look at the new details, the unanimous vote required for the death penalty and the appeal option and so on, do the tribunals now escape the label that William Safire put on them, kangaroo courts?
I don't believe they necessarily do. Bill's a friend of mine, and he did not say such things lightly. Both he and I have criticized these courts in strong terms because they still lack some very basic protections. There is a remaining question of why we don't try these individuals in federal court. None of the arguments made by the administration are particularly compelling. I've done espionage cases, both in federal court and military courts, and they have been very secure, and we've done this process in the past in other terrorism cases, including Al-Qaeda-related cases. So there's, in my view, still a significant question of why the administration is doing this. There's a very strong impression that the reason they're creating this tribunal is because it's doubtful that they could convict many of these individuals, that most of these individuals do not have sufficient incriminating evidence.
And yet the circumstances are so awkward because there's a tremendous desire to do something with people who have been such a threat. Yet, as you said, even the location of a trial is now an issue. Why is that?
Well, the administration clearly would like to keep this trial outside the United States, and so there's a possibility it will be held in Cuba. Guam has also been suggested. And it seems to me that that is primarily a tactical move in that, you know, there's nothing better for the administration, I think, than to put this controversial court in a place like the Cuba military base, where the public and media would have a considerably more difficult time in monitoring the trial. And one of the questions that I have, actually, is whether there's been any long-term thought about this. You know, the tribunal was sort of presented as if it sort of sprang from the head of Zeus.
Full, complete, and not to be questioned.
That's right. And I think that the administration is now trying to make improvements on what was a poorly crafted order.
With all the talk about the military tribunals, though, what do you make of the decision to prosecute the first accused terrorist, Zacharias Moussaoui, in the civil court system?
I think they had a very good idea that the Moussaoui case would be a problem if they tried to use the tribunal. One of the mistakes that they made in the executive order was the suggestion that they could use the tribunal for foreign nationals arrested within the United States, which really runs against a whole line of precedent by the Supreme Court. The Moussaoui case, I think, was an admission by the administration that it did step too far. But the administration clearly wants to try to get this guy convicted of a 9/11 count to so that somebody is held directly accountable. The problem is that Moussaoui's connection to these hijackers is extremely extended and inferential.
From the sound of everything you're saying, it feels like there may be a challenge out there somewhere. Is there a way for these courts to be challenged in the civil courts in the United States?
I think that there is a way to challenge it. You know, the administration is forcing a rather novel issue, but we have a system of government of shared powers, and I think the judiciary will view some aspect of this tribunal to be legitimately the subject of a challenge.
Jonathan Turley is a professor at the George Washington University Law School. He spoke to us from Washington. The attack on Pearl Harbor, the assassinations of JFK, RFK, and MLK, the Challenger disaster. Every generation has its moment of searing pain that reaches deep into its soul and psyche. For today's generation of American children, it is September 11th, 2001. How are your children coping? What do you think the impact of the attacks will be on their psychological, social, even political development in the years ahead? Does 9/11 truly mark the end of innocence, even for the youngest? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from San Francisco is Dr. Lynn Ponton. She is professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco, and chair of the Disaster and Trauma Committee of the American Academy of Child Psychiatrists. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Lynn Ponton.
It's a pleasure to be on your show, Tom.
Great to have you. Also with us here in the studio is special coverage news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Lynn Ponton, we're very grateful to you for joining us tonight. And in the background of all the conversations we've had this fall has been this question: how are children processing this? It's adults and their deep fears and concerns and responses to trauma that are front and center. But we know that children are watching all of this. In the 3 months after the attack, what stands out for you in the way America's children are responding?
Well, I think your comments are very apt, Tom. One of the saddest things is we tried to limit child viewing of the tragedy directly the day that it occurred and the day after.
When you say we, do you mean many parents tried to limit that?
All the child psychiatrists worked as an organization.
I see.
And actually NPR joined, and Morning Edition ran several programs with me talking to the parents, nation's parents, trying to limit viewing of the media-based tragedy. But it's so extensive that there really has not been a way to do that.
Now I somehow missed that. Is this like putting on sunglasses to watch an eclipse of the sun? Is there some permanent psychological sear that comes from seeing the dust and rubble again and again?
There is. And I think maybe it's important to talk about what the viewing meant for many children, how much media coverage they really saw, and a lot of children saw maybe more than 20 hours of coverage, and then what we know about the impact of the coverage of that type of tragedy on children. And we actually know a fair amount about it based on the different events that you mentioned. The Challenger disaster was studied extensively by a Dr. Lenore Terre. She looked at children of all three age groups, the adolescents, the middle age group, and then the preschoolers. And she discovered that children who were viewing the Challenger disaster right at the site, who were there in Florida when it happened and saw it blow up, reacted, of course, very seriously over about a two-year period. She also looked at comparison groups across the country, children who saw it on television, and they, too, had a reaction to it, strong reaction to it, that lasted for about a two-year period. So this is just one study, though, that indicates that children watching a traumatic image, and September 11th was a very, it was a series of traumatic images. There wasn't just one. There are four or five that the children seem to focus on.
Oh, yeah, there was no shortage.
Yeah, no, I think that there are a couple that just to talk about because, you know, seeing children in therapy 3 months later, you hear about them over and over again.
What are the images that come up particularly, Lynn Ponton?
The plane crashes are a big one. And the plane crashing into the World Trade Center is number one. And when you go to schools and you look at drawings that children have made about this period, that's the first thing that you see. The second is a kind of ground zero drawing with no World Trade Center, nothing there, big hole.
A hole in the world.
Exactly. And so that's the second image that seems to be having the most impact.
Lynn Ponton, you've really got our attention around this this issue of how much of this children would be advised to see. You know, it's too late to go back and rerun the tape from September 11th. They've seen what they've seen. But just at that prescriptive level, even now, are you recommending that children be shielded from the repetitions even now of this on television?
What we recommended on Morning Edition, Tom, right away, you know, as chair of the Disaster and Trauma Committee, I think what parents could have done was, first of all, limit the amount of viewing at one time. All children over the age of 4 or 5 wanted to watch it.
Sure, because adults were so fixated on it, among other things.
Children under 4 or 5 probably should not have been viewing. And we know this from studies that we did in the San Francisco earthquake, where we looked at younger children's reaction.
We want to come back after a break and talk about that. But talk to us, give us a glimpse of what is the impact of on a child who has sat and watched that again and again, or maybe just a half a dozen times over 3 months. What's the psychological impact?
Well, it leaves what we call a traumatic image that reoccurs and affects children in different ways. Younger children are more scared. The middle age group has more behavioral stuff, problems in school. And teenagers have more acting out or risk-taking behavior. So in brief, each group reacts with symptoms indicating how unhappy they really are about that type of viewing.
And how widespread are you hearing from your committee on disaster and trauma? How widespread are these kinds of problems that could result from that viewing?
Everywhere, actually, roughly about 8 weeks after the disaster, we started to see an upsurge in children and adolescents coming to psychiatric and psychological clinics and with symptoms related to September 11th. So it's a good time to talk about it now with the nation's parents because the problems your child might be having this month could relate to what they viewed and what they experienced during that period.
Jack Beatty, what are you hearing when you hear these warnings and the possible knock-on effect on children? It's not the first time there have been traumas that American children have been aware of over time, but do you think this one is somehow different?
I don't know. It certainly was different historically. We can safely say that. This was an unprecedented event, an attack on the capital city of the homeland, an attack on the main city of the homeland. It hasn't happened in our history, except for 1812, and that's too distant. I'm curious to ask you, Dr. Ponton, how are children understanding this event? I mean, as adults, we can barely understand it. How are the different groups trying to fathom it?
That's a very good question, too, Jack, because the other thing we recommended the morning of the disaster was that if you allow your child to view with them then turn off the television and talk about it.
We're going to talk about it more after a short break. Hang on, Dr. Lynn Ponton, Jack Beatty. We're talking about how our children are taking on board the events of September 11th and the entire aftermath. What a series of images. Imagine yourself at age 5, age 10, age 15, trying to process what that meant. How are your children responding to September 11th? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about America's children and maybe the world's children as well and the effect of 9/11 on their psyches, on their view of society, on their view of politics, on their view of the world. Have you seen a difference in the behavior of your children in their outlook since 9/11? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined from California by Dr. Lynn Ponton. She's chair of the Disaster and Trauma Committee of the American Academy of Child Psychiatrists. Dr. Ponton, just before the break, Jack Beatty was asking about what you're seeing about how kids are processing the meaning of 9/11. And I wonder if you'd share what you heard with us first in terms of how they process it in terms of worldly affairs, conflict between states or peoples or groups, but also how are they processing it in terms of the meaning, its meaning, I guess, as relates to human nature?
Okay. I'll do my best to answer that. I think first, the nation's children are not talking enough about it. And what's missing, we get a lot of input from the media every day about this crisis and the ongoing impact. But schools are still avoiding the topic. Parents don't talk about it with their children. They sit and they watch TV together. But then they don't share their own viewpoint, which is what's so important. So kids are still very confused about it. I'm not talking about five-year-olds. I'm talking about 15, 18-year-olds.
Yeah.
So I think what parents can do is every night at dinner or when you're driving your kids to school in the morning or taking the bus together, check in for a few minutes and say, did you hear about this? This is the way I understand it today. Do you have any questions? Be sure to ask me.
Are children open to that? I know I've heard kids say to me, listen, we're going to listen to the news, and I'll bet you that within 5 seconds they'll say the word Afghanistan. I'm sick of hearing about terror. I've heard this from children. Do you hear that, Dr. Ponton?
I do. And I think a lot from a lot of kids, that's a signal that they've had too much of this. But it's too much, really, media exposure and maybe not enough talk. And I would use that as a jumping-off place with my own kids. And I have two teenage daughters and say to them, okay, you know, why are you filled up with it? What could we do about it? What do you think they should have on TV about it? So you start the conversation from their perspective.
Listeners, how are you interpreting 9/11 for the children in your life? What are you telling children about the meaning of 9/11? What are your children telling you? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Lynn Ponton, we don't want to let you off the hook about how kids are interpreting this, about what they're saying, what you're hearing them say about how nations and peoples get along and about human nature itself.
That they actually, I think, are showing us through their behavior, Tom, because although they may not be talking about it, they are acting, and children tend to act out things. And what we're starting to see with the kids in schools, the middle age group is more fighting in the classrooms, on the playground.
Physical fighting.
Exactly. And the games already, children's games take on the flavor of world news. After the San Francisco earthquake, there were earthquake games going on. And right now there are a lot of war games and also terrorist games. And that's incorporated into the children's play. That's another place I think parents can look and think, how's my fourth grade son John really processing this? And then look at, well, what games are John and his friends playing right now and what are they saying? And that's a real clue about what our kids think. And they are imitating the behavior that they really see in the news. With teenagers, there's a lot more risk-taking. In particular, there's, you know, the violent risk-taking continues, but there's a lot of sexual risk-taking.
Now, as a psychiatrist, how do you connect the dots between 9/11 and that?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, my specialty, I've written a lot about adolescent sexual risk-taking. It's actually my area of specialty.
And you have a new book out, Lynn Ponton, The Sex Lives of Teenagers, so we know you're paying attention to this realm.
Right. What I think, and we saw this a bit with adults in the 2 to 3 month period afterwards, is they reached out for comfort and intimate relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Teenagers are not that different from adults, mm-hmm. but they don't necessarily use the same protection. So I think risk of sexually transmitted diseases is at an all-time high right now for our teenagers. And I think that's something else that parents need to be paying attention to and making sure that their kids are trying to be safe. It is natural, I think, to reach out to friends and to want some intimacy at a time like this and closeness.
Mm-hmm.
But it's real important that teens protect themselves.
Listeners, what kind of children, what kind of adults do you think 9/11 will produce? And what are you hearing from your children? We're at 1-800-423-8255 with Dr. Lynn Ponton. She's a professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco. Joan is on the line. Welcome, Joan. You're on the air. Hello, Joan, are you there? Sounds like we may have lost her. Let's try John. John, are you there? Oh, we're having trouble with the telephones. We'll come back in a moment. Jack Beatty, here we are, and we've talked, as we set all this up, about the lineup of historical precedents that one might cite, from Pearl Harbor,
yeah.
and crash of 29, right on through to the assassinations of the 60s. How have you seen the impact of those events playing through American history in their wake?
Well, you know, historic events can become metaphors, and the metaphors then organize thought, and they get carried forward into the future. And sometimes they get applied, misapplied to situations they don't fit. The classic example, really, is the metaphor of Munich. A whole generation of American policymakers, those who were in control in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
took from the Munich metaphor the idea that you have to stop aggression at its root, you know, before it reaches San Francisco.
Never step Johnson. Back, never stand down.
Never stand down. I mean, it's you got and young McGeorge Bundy said he'd never forgotten what he called the terrible spring of 1940 when Hitler marched into Paris. And that froze these people, and they applied that to Vietnam, where it didn't fit at all. The entire skein of events was different. The causalities were different, with tragic historic results. Of course, we're not sure what the metaphor of 9/11 will mean to people for whom this is the first, you know, collision with history with a capital H. It's ironic. Vietnam itself, of course, became a metaphor, and conservatives say it's a metaphor that's held U.S. foreign policy in thrall, leading to, you know, Munich-like appeasement of terrorists. So metaphors can be mischievous politically and historically, a sort of group, I don't want to say psychosis, but a kind of, you know, paradigm that people have to make sense of life. But history changes. There are new circumstances. And if you're enthralled to these past metaphors, it can play you false.
And certainly those images of 9/11 are, you know, powerfully pull anyone into their thrall.
Yes.
And children. Lynn Ponton, what about that? Are you, and do you hear with your pals in the world of child psychiatry, do you project forward at all about what kind of adult generation the fact of 9/11 might produce?
Well, I think what Jack is saying is interesting, and I would agree that these tragedies actually earmark a generation. And one of the things that I've seen in particular is young teens and most frequently young men are concerned about potential service in Afghanistan.
Yeah, out of fear or readiness or ambivalence?
Both. Mm-hmm. But it, in a way, mobilizes a generation. They have to think about this. They haven't been thinking about this before.
Mm-hmm.
It, in some ways, helps them to grow up.
So there it's not necessarily, I mean, it is a wound of sorts, but could it ironically be a source of strength as well?
Well, it is a risk or a developmental thrust where they have to either develop resilient tactics and grow stronger, or they suffer, and that's what mm-hmm. you see. The viewing the trauma is different. We know that's injurious. Mm-hmm. But I think when you face a difficult situation, and this is a difficult situation for our young people,
mm-hmm.
many of them mature, develop, learn skills. Many of the schools right now are putting on, you were talking about the tribunal earlier.
Mm-hmm. Military
a lot of the
tribunal.
High schools are acting out these things and talking about having world courts that look at this incident. That's a way where we can get our young people involved very positively, and I think help them learn and grow from this.
Listeners, what about the traumas that shaped your childhood, JFK, Pearl Harbor, Challenger? Do they compare, and how do you feel them working out in your lives today? I think we have our phones back. We're at 1-800-423-8255. John is on the line. John, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm calling. I have a four-year-old daughter.
Mm-hmm.
She just turned four, so she was slightly younger, around September time frame. And around October, driving down to a zoo in Providence, she had a friend with her about the same age who was excited to see the city, tall buildings,
mm-hmm.
mentioned it to my daughter, who said, yeah, but you can't go in those because sometimes they fall down.
Mm. So she hasn't missed a thing.
She hasn't missed a thing, and we were out for a walk maybe no more than a month ago, and really out of the blue started asking, what did the people say when the plane hit the building? What did God say? What did the people's mothers say when the plane hit the building?
Your four-year-old daughter was asking this?
Yes.
Wow. Lynn Ponton, is this typical? And John, thank you very much for your call. Lynn, is this typical? And you've mentioned several times that parents should talk to their children. If you've got a child this young age, I don't know, from 4 or 5 up to 9 or 10, what do you tell them?
I think with the younger group, 5 and under, and first, it is typical, and second, John is fortunate that his daughter feels okay to ask these questions
mm-hmm.
and is thinking this way. The fact that she wonders about God and the people in the building, you know, it shows that she's developing empathy and concern at a very young age.
And she wonders openly, sharing it with her parents and being able to get their input.
And so I would say that to say to her you're happy that she's thinking about these things, but you know it must be scary. You're going to do everything possible to keep her safe,
mm-hmm.
but I would even maybe walk through with her a bit what the people might have been thinking, and they might have been thinking about their families, and they probably thought that it was very sad that it was happening to them, and
mm-hmm.
It is hard for kids. If this continues, though, I would say more than 2 or 3 months, and I see many 4 and 5-year-olds who have fears or they're obsessed about this,
mm-hmm.
and they may be focused on 1 4-year-old saw the jumpers go out of the building.
Oh, gee.
And that 4 or 5-year-old now only plays games where people fall and jump out of buildings.
John, I think you're still there. Does Lynn Ponton's suggested message line up with what you told your daughter? How have you handled her questions?
It does. To a certain extent, we felt the only thing we could do was try and, certainly not skirt the issue, but
mm-hmm.
try and address it at a level with which she could understand it. So
mm-hmm.
sort of talk about, the bad people that did it, that the police are going to find them and things of that nature. But, I guess the earlier question when they were sort of seeing tall buildings in the Providence area and making that comment, didn't really surprise us as much as the seemingly random ones on the walk about what did God say? What did, we didn't really, I wasn't there for that, and I don't quite know how my wife and sister-in-law reacted to that.
But questions as big as you're ever going to hear from the mouths of babes. John, thanks for your call. Maureen is on the line. Welcome, Maureen. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been wondering a lot about what injury this has done to my children and my friends' children, and I've thought a lot about it since September 11th, and I've had some great conversations, in fact, with my teenage son, my children a little older, because it has been injurious. And, you know, I think we've all given a lot of morbid thought to things we never would have thought of before. So this brings me to my comment. In thinking about all of this, when you think about the bigger picture for
mm-hmm.
whatever it is, 200,000 years, children have been witnessing their parents and the adults' acts of war. And it has shaped us evolutionarily and as a civilization and,
mm-hmm.
you know, in terms of men make war and, you know, women take care of the children.
Mm-hmm. A lot of castles were burnt to the ground, a lot of villages.
But we managed to survive, didn't we?
Mm-hmm. We did.
Although I don't doubt that it is injurious, I wonder, you know, is it really that horrible?
Well, it's a great question. Let's put it to Lynn Ponton. What about it? Is this something that we are just hardwired, even as children, to deal with, Lynn Ponton? Are we too quick to think that our contemporary children are somehow frail vessels that can't take the storm?
First, to thank Maureen for her comments and thoughtful questions. A couple of things. First, violence is learned. It's not necessarily a hardwired behavior for the most part, and there are many studies that really document this.
Meaning that we are in some ways enslaved by the history of war that Maureen describes.
Right, and that kids learn from their parents really about this particular behavior. There's just no doubt about it. And we saw that around Columbine. You know, we've seen that around a number of incidents. But I think most telling, I work with the children who've been directly exposed to war. For example, in Mozambique, I actually went there and may likely go to Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And I think when you see a country where the children have been very directly exposed, you know, they are dramatically altered by it. And the closer they are to the events, the greater the impact.
And how would you describe that impact?
The impact is, I think, first, they is often tragic. They lose their childhood. There's many, many anxiety disorders and traumas that they carry with them related to it. Learning violence, aggressive, sadistic behavior. You know, we saw that, for example, in the Sarajevo area with young people. This is a learned pattern. So I would say, yes, our children have survived thousands of years of war and, you know, we go on as a species, but that's not a reason to not look at it, evaluate it, and think about other lessons that we could be teaching our children instead of this.
Jack Beatty, the suggestion there is that, yes, it's been around, but that doesn't make it a good thing. And the impact is a sad one for a generation that has to take it in the teeth.
It sure is. And I just want to ask Dr. Ponton this. Robert Lifton, years ago, writing about Hiroshima and the people affected by that, talked about a phenomenon called psychic numbing, whereby in order to survive something like that, in order to even to process it psychologically, the psyche essentially becomes numb, depressed. You don't feel it. And I think he went on to make the generalization that technology in general has created for all of us, and the nuclear arms race and other things, a kind of psychic numbing, that we can't function in this world with all this media report of violence and horror without psychic numbing. And my question to you is, does that happen? Do you see it? And what are the consequences of that? Does that limit empathy? How does that work?
Well, that's a good point to bring up, Jack, because psychic numbing, where adults or children are really tuned out to a traumatic event, they've been overwhelmed, they've experienced a trauma, and they really tune it out. And you can see signs of this where kids will watch television for number of hours, and you'll see no eye movements. They'll be looking away. They won't know what they've seen. So there is quite a bit of it. We saw psychic numbing the day of 9/11 and the day following, because we saw it with all of the workers and the people in the New York and the Washington area. So you can see what those people, what the faces look like. This happens to children. And you really do not want children really zoned down, tuned out to what's going on around them.
Lynn Ponton will come back and talk a little bit more about that after a short break. We're talking with Lynn Ponton, chair of the Disaster and Trauma Committee of the American Academy of Child Psychiatrists, about the impact of 9/11 and its aftermath on children. You can join the conversation. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the impact of 9/11 on children. The impact on adults has been bad enough, but what about kids working through this? What are you telling children about the meaning of 9/11, and what are your children telling you? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined by Dr. Lynn Ponton, chair of the Disaster and Trauma Committee of the American Academy of Child Psychiatrists. You can join the conversation. Tehran is on the line. Welcome, Tehran. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening, Tom.
Good evening.
I have a comment to make. the children who belong to the age group that can understand the terrorists were Muslims mm-hmm. and came from a Muslim nation mm-hmm. will grow up to be adults with deep-rooted ill will and hatred for the Muslim religion, which is going to cause a big divide in the society, which otherwise United States is a melting pot of races and culture.
Yeah.
And I come from India. Mm-hmm. A Hindu kid, which is 5 years old, will say Muslims are bad because Pakistan has been aiding and abetting mm-hmm. terrorism. Mm-hmm. But it's not a fact. All Muslims are not bad. But a Hindu kid grows up with the fact in its mind.
Just because it's in the environment.
Yes, it's because in the environment, politics talk about it, newspapers talk about it.
And the seed is planted. Tehran, it's a great question. Hang on, let's put it to Lynn Ponton. What about it, Lynn? I myself have seen young children. I remember the cover of a Time magazine with a very angry close-up face of a Pakistani shouting in the streets against Uncle Sam. And I saw a seven-year-old actually hit that photograph with her fist. And I wondered to myself, is there a lifelong seed planted here somehow? What do you say?
Well, Tehran is bringing up an important issue. Stigma and prejudice are really learned as children. You know, those are seeds that are planted very, very early, and we carry them through our lives. We can see directly the Middle Eastern children that I've worked with over the past 3 months have experienced a lot of prejudice in their schools and with their friends and families.
These are Middle Eastern children in the United States.
Yes, yes. So it's already happened. And a number of Middle Eastern children were just beginning, you know, of Middle Eastern heritage, were just beginning college.
So the stigma is explicit and specific. Even in a young child's mind, they will associate this with a certain look or a certain even a religion?
Yes, that's right, Tom.
That's kind of a high concept association, isn't it?
Well, you know, Tom, quite honestly, I don't think of prejudice as a high concept association.
No, thinking of Muslims, as Tehran says, is the
and
other.
In fact, they don't discriminate very well. So they can look at a dark-skinned child who appears to be Middle Eastern and think that child is one of our enemy, in quotes. And so I think that's important to remember with our children, that if we say we hate a group or a group is bad, our children will take that in and they'll apply it not only to that small group, which is unfortunate enough, but to a much wider group. Mm-hmm. So kids are not very good, really, at defining
making distinctions.
Exactly.
Tehran, you've taken us into a rich vein. Thank you for your call. What about, I guess, in this regard, Lynn Ponton, think with us about the White House and the messages from there for a minute. We've heard the word evil and evildoer over and over. We've heard Osama bin Laden, alive or dead, it doesn't matter to me. We all understand where these feelings come from, but how do children process that kind of rough, tough, let's go get him, and the evildoer phrasing?
Well, they certainly take it in, and we want our children to see the complexity of the world. That's sometimes hard, but people are not good and bad or good and evil. There's a wide range here, and we'll work hard to help our children really understand this. So when the president or other groups describe somebody that way, it means that we've got to spend a lot of time talking with our kids. And I talked to a whole high school after our president had made his speech where he talked about evildoers. And they said, well, that's the way we see it here in high school now. We've got groups. We've got the evildoers here. Mm-hmm. And we had to spend a whole morning really talking before they could begin to see that there really are other ways to look at the world. So it has tremendous impact, that type of phrase.
If you were president or had his ear, would you suggest a different word, a different approach as far as child's development goes? And what would it be?
I think first, one of our earlier callers said it very directly. John, he said he was going to use the words that his four-year-old would understand. So I think you do it by age group, and with the kids under five, you explain it simply, but you still don't use the good-bad connotation or the good-evil. And you can describe it with, these people did something to our country. This is what they did. We don't like it. A lot of people have been killed, and we're going to do something about it. Keep it simple.
But Lynn Ponton, you know, this has been taken by many people precisely the opposite way, as an opportunity to say, here's an example of something that is simply bad.
I think there, Tom, it's difficult when you get into this, because Jack was talking some about metaphors and their application. And when you look at historical metaphors and the impact, things are complex. And this was a very serious act against our country. Many people were hurt, and it was an unjust and unfair act. There's no doubt about that. But how we talk about it and help our children process it, and how we help them see the complexity of this, they're going to ask, why did these people do this? Mm-hmm. That's one of the first things they ask.
Sure.
And you have to come up with an explanation, and there are many. You know, it doesn't justify the act, but I think to let children know that people do not do these things because they're evil. There are complex reasons why they do them.
Lynn Ponton, this is a subject we could spend hours on with you, and we don't have them, but we're very grateful to you for coming on with us tonight. Thanks very much for joining us.
Tom, it's a pleasure. It's a great show, and Boston's lucky to have you.
Thanks. Take care. Dr. Lynn Ponton is chair of the Disaster and Trauma Committee of the American Academy of Child Psychiatrists. She's a professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco, and author of the new book, The Sex Lives of Teenagers. Jack Beatty, now there's an alternate view from someone who's intimately, you know, engaged with children and their psyches, saying it's too simple to just call this evil. But how many parents have taken this as a teachable moment about exactly that, evil and good?
Yeah, I think she's looking at it through a sort of developmental psychological framework. People with a religious framework, of course, are not have a precedent for using the word evil. I mean, that's part of the vocabulary. I just think this is a different way of looking at things. People who use the religious outlook, there is evil. It's in the theology. And the whole business of religion really is to explain how evil came to be, not to deny it. Mm-hmm. I heard a little bit in what she was saying that, you know, well, we should really deny it, or, you know, acts can have causes and still be committed by wicked, terrible people. And,
yeah.
Not that it's not bad.
It's bad, kids. Don't try this.
Yes.
Don't do this. Wow, what a world of processing is going on out there right now in all those minds across the country. Jack, hang on. We're going to listen to some sounds of this past week before the hour ends.
The individual was attempting to light a shoe on fire that had some wires attached to
the traditional midnight mass at the Church of the Nativity, as Christians from around the world gather to hear tidings of peace and goodwill.
We confront an external and internal challenge, but let me assure my countrymen that your armed forces are fully prepared and capable of defeating all challenges by the grace of Allah.
After 3 months since the attacks, the blessed attacks against took place against the head of the snake, the United States, and after 2 months since the Crusader campaign started against Islam.
We hear 6, 7, 8, 10, 12 conflicting reports every day. I've stopped chasing them. We do know of certain knowledge that he is either in Afghanistan or in some other country or dead.
This war will go on for some time to find the terrorists, to eliminate terrorism. I don't know how long it'll go on. It'll go on probably for a longer time than we would like. But I hope you realize that we've already won it.
They're still in discussions about how best to bring justice. But one thing is for certain, that whatever the procedures are for the military tribunals, our system will be more fair than the system of bin Laden and the Taliban. That is for certain. The prisoners that we capture will be given a heck of a lot better chance in court than those citizens of ours who were in the World Trade Center or in the Pentagon were given by Mr. bin Laden.
Sounds from this past week, and what a range. A shoe bomb, the President Musharraf of Pakistan on readiness for war, the new bin Laden tape, even now after the bombing of Tor Bor, though we don't know its date, sarcastic Donald Rumsfeld on where bin Laden is, Giuliani saying we've won, Bush on figuring out how to deal with al-Qaeda prisoners. You know, Jack, I get the feeling that as a nation, we've scrambled back to a sense of stability. And that in itself is an achievement, an accomplishment. But there's a kind of thinness to this confidence in its depth, even in its reality, this stability.
Yeah, just as you read in the paper that the New York Times was planning to end its Nation Challenge section on the war on terror.
Folding that tent.
Yeah, the Nation gets challenged anew with this bomber on the plane who clearly has some connection to Al-Qaeda and who clearly is not the last of these people. And this Bin Laden tape, he really drew attention to his war on the economy. He said more strikes are required, and the youths must strike the key sectors of the American economy. Boy, attacking airliners again, that is just we're the targets, but so is the economy. This is an insidious, this just isn't random. They're picking their targets.
No, and it started out sounding a just slightly silly, a shoe bomb, but when you think it through, it's not at all.
No.
Tom Friedman says, what's next? We're going to start naked air, fly naked, be safe. Is that the only way? I mean, take it as a metaphor. We can't be naked. There are economic and
yes.
social and political aspects that we have to have here, and yet the threat is right there. You know, and that on this sense of stability, I feel like Washington, the White House, the whole country has really leaned into it as we came into the holidays because no one wanted to end a year feeling at loose ends. And still, we're told the war's not over. We don't have Bin Laden. And even the home front is not necessarily secure.
Yeah, the new normal is precarious, and it may remain that way for a long, long time. And that's, you know, talk about children getting used to this. That's how I think all of us are starting to process this. Oh, my gosh, this isn't the end of it. This is going to go on. These cells are around the world, and God knows if there are more recruits to them.
And the president's new standard here, however we act in our military tribunals and in our execution of justice, we will be more fair than the system of Bin Laden. This is not a high bar.
No, that's right. Murder versus due process. No.
Jack, cast your mind back for just a minute with us, if you can, and imagine yourself a year ago, end of year 2000, and here we are, end of year 2001. Contrast and compare.
Well, you know, I was thinking about this, and it going back to last year, let's look at George Bush. You know, and the remarkable thing about him is in contrast to Bill Clinton in 1992, Bush has kept his campaign promises. And we've sort of lost that in the year. I mean, Clinton scrapped the economic program he ran on, including the promise of a middle-class tax cut. He scrapped his China policy and other things to govern, not Bush, with no mandate, selected president by Supreme Court justices appointed by his father and Reagan, he asserted a mandate and has pursued it across the board from foreign policy to taxes to energy to abortion rights. He proved Ralph Nader wrong. Elections matter. And I think this is important. I think it helps to restore meaning to elections. And I think Clinton, by his reversals, really damaged that. Yes. Elections matter.
And even in a season of war and with an entire new global campaign launched, you still feel the thrust of that Bush campaign promise.
Bush is just going straight ahead. September 11th did not affect the idea about the, you know, missile defense. The new relations with Russia does not affect that. I said it in the campaign, and I'm going to do it now. Now, you can argue with the policy. I certainly do. But there's something, you know, refreshing about a president who said, I'm going to do what I said.
And does the attack of 9/11 and the war on terror make it easier for him to push that agenda through, or more difficult? Sounds like easier.
I think it may be easier for a lot of this. Not on the economic side, however. Mm-hmm. There he may be more tax cuts as the answer to an economy, our economy today. Mm-hmm. This may not sell. I think there is a difference there. But in foreign policy, and perhaps even with missile defense, he may have it much more his own way than he would have prior to September 11th.
And outside our borders, if there's a silver lining a year later, to me at least, it seems like that terrible blow of September 11th maybe at least really woke American sensibilities up to the world, to what's going on out there.
Yeah, and maybe over the next decade we won't cut, I think it's by 30% the amount of money we spend on the State Department and foreign aid and the rest.
Maybe not this time.
Maybe not this time.
Jack, we've got a lot more shows, but maybe not live ones. I want to wish you a Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you and our listeners.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is